You look at some of these archetypes of what women like nowadays. I think men, we have to learn that you got to be able to turn it on and turn it off a little bit. You're macho. Okay, welcome to today's podcast, radio episode, The Ty Lopez Show. I've got a special guest. I ran into his book somewhere in all my book collecting, The Evolution of Beauty, Richard Prum, and he was gracious enough to join us. We're going to be talking about a very interesting subject. So one of the most common questions I've tweeted about this, and it always gets people riled up, is should you date and marry for beauty, for looks, or for personality? And I've read your book 1.5 times, and so Richard has a very interesting take on this. Now, Dr. David Buss has been on my show a few times, and he is more of a classic evolutionary psychologist, and you have somewhat of a disruptive conversation. So, by the way, my grandma went to Yale. So, by the way, Richard is a professor at Yale. You do what? Is it the ornithology?
Yeah, I'm a professor of ecology and evolutionary biology, but really I'm a ornithologist, which is a bird guy.
Bird guy. And if you know anything about evolution, a lot of it, Darwin talked a lot about, you know, the peacock's plume and all this kind of stuff. So birds played a big role in us understanding. So I want to jump right into it, even before we go live here. Why is it so hard for people to accept theories of beauty? Like you talk about in your book, you're not the most popular person with this theory. Is it because not many people are pretty, and so no one likes to hear a theory that being pretty is important?
No, I think what really happens is that people are freaked out by scientific solutions that are, if you will, off the ranch. You know, most people believe that in evolutionary biology, believe that adaptation is a strong force. You know, natural selection is a strong force that dictates the important outcomes in evolution. And people want that powerful idea to be true. And so they try to reconstruct beauty in a way that conforms to that idea. And I think Darwin are telling a really different story. And that's why people don't want to hear it.
Yeah. And so basically, for those listening, and you should obviously summarize this, but what I took away, and we'll talk about this a few times, especially when we go live, but you know, the classic theory is that everything in evolution has a specific purpose. People, female or males, they mate because this one's stronger, will bring more food to the table. And your book basically says, yes, there's some truth to that, but some of it is just pure, unexplainable attractiveness that attracts things sometimes. Is that a poor boy explanation?
Well, we're getting there. I mean, really, the idea is, I really think that beauty is can function like an irrationally exuberant market bubble, right? Mm. It can evolve and detach value away from its some kind of objective standard, right? And it happens in economics. Why not in nature? This is a kind of powerful and kind of disruptive idea that beauty could evolve for its own sake.
Yeah, the war. I just saw a movie. It was what was it? The Roses War of the Roses. It wasn't War of the Roses, but it's a new one. It actually flopped. It's an indie, and it's about back several hundred years ago in Netherlands. There was this big tulip. It was a tulip war. I think that's what the movie's called. And, you know, it's actually a Weinstein movie, which we all know Weinstein's in the news a lot,
yeah,
right
how
now.
How does that factor into the evolution?
That's not factored in. But, you know, there was an exuberance where people were literally becoming millionaires by investing in tulips, and then it crashed, and it's very similar to 2008 and 1929 and 1987.
Absolutely.
So and so is that kind of what you're talking about?
Yeah,
the exuberance.
And I think it's not an accident that the first market bubble, which you describe, was about something that's beautiful.
Right.
The whole idea of the tulip bulb is that it's beauty. It's
right.
Beauty in a plant that people want to collect and grow in their house and expand the beauty of their lives. So, I mean, the fact that it's beautiful really contributed to the idea that it could be totally irrational and unstable and crash. And I think that's a property of biological marketplaces too. They're just sexual marketplaces.
Right. And you know, it's funny with beauty. I think that, and what I want to get into this a little bit is like defining beauty, and also in a little bit later talking about what's the implications, like what is it, your book, The Evolution of Beauty, How Darwin's Forgotten Theory of Mate Choice Shapes Us, Shapes the Animal World and Us, like what's the takeaways? But before we get to that, because I want to do that when we're live, what is an example? You talk about an example of ducks, and I thought this was pretty interesting. Actually, I want to go, let's go live with this because people are going to find this interesting. All right, so I'm going to do a little, give me 1 minute. I'm going to do a little separate intro. Should I just call you Professor Prum? Do you go by that?
Call me Rick.
Okay. Professor Rick. I like that.
No, just Rick.
Professor Rick, it sounds good.
Bro, but just go with Rick. That's survival.
Okay. And I'm going to put one thing that I was just wondering, how in the world did you even stumble upon this?
This being the beauty of birds or?
No. That beauty, you have a disruptive theory in evolution. Was that?
I'm a bird nut. I started at about the age of 10 and I never considered doing anything else in the world. Right. And I'm 45 years into this whole thing, the study of beauty of birds. And, you spend that amount of time, that amount of focus, and you learn a thing. And that's where I'm at.
So basically the love of birds led to the discovery how important beauty was among birds. And then humans.
Decades of scientific study.
Good. All right. I'm going to do this and I'm going to do some giveaways during this. So I'm going to announce them here at the beginning. I'm going to hold this book up. All right. So everybody smile. We're going to get a thumbnail for YouTube first. Ready? Here we go. All right. We got our thumbnail. So we'll go live very fast on all four of them. 1, 2, 3, and 4. What is up, everybody? I'm going live. I'm actually here live on 4 different places, YouTube. We're talking about the beauty of humans and what it means for sexuality, what it means for you, what it means for dating life. State of the end. We're here, by the way, with Professor Rick Prum. He doesn't like to be called professor, but we'll call him that. He's a professor at Yale. And basically, I want to talk about why beauty is important. And what he found, because it's very interesting. We think of beauty as not very important. But one of the questions, you know, is beauty skin deep? Does personality matter in dating? These are huge questions that people have. Are you in the right connection?
Yeah. For sure?
Huh. Instagram's usually the most stable of all. So we'll be taking questions. Someone says, Mark Benny Pio says, you should just date whoever is compatible with you. David Smith says, personality is better, but beauty is okay for me. Beauty rots, personality doesn't. That's a pretty interesting take. But if you, this is a great book, by the way. I've read it 1.5 times.
3, 2.
Yeah, just go. It already has a 3, 2, 1 counter. There we go. Here, now we got Instagram. This is the big one. What's up, Instagram? I'm giving away cash, giving away iPhone 7 at the end. So pay attention. I'm here with Professor Rick Prum. We're talking about his book, The Evolution of Beauty. He's a professor at Yale, and he has a controversial theory about how important beauty is. We forget about this. So I'm going to be asking questions throughout. This is for my live podcast. And so just call you Rick. He likes to be called Rick. He's a humble guy. So what are your book talks all about this. We were just talking about this on my podcast, about how important beauty is. The role beauty plays, even if we can't figure out the purpose of beauty, that beauty is important. If you watch TV, if you look at Instagram posts, beautiful people are getting more likes. You look at girls on Instagram, you have, you know, these girls have 15 million followers and they're being followed, not necessarily because of personality. It might be personality, but they definitely are above average beauty. Before we get into the science of this, what's the practical implications of your book for somebody watching? The Evolution of Beauty, do we just all get depressed and go, if you're not super beautiful, you're not going to mate, you're not going to find love. Like, what do we need to know here?
Yeah. Well, I think the lesson from my book is that, you know, beauty is a social contrivance. It's invented by people, by us, by groups of people.
Okay.
And what that means is, you know, humans in particular have the evolved capacity to find themselves and other people beautiful. And not only that, that we're especially evolved in order to be satisfied, to find long-lasting and satisfying relationships. So I think the message of the book is really optimistic for people.
So one of the things in your book you're talking about, you're a bird specialist, ornithologist, love birds since you were 10 years old. This is kind of how you stumbled upon this theory. Now, the devil's advocate or people on the other side of scale that are more classical evolutionary psychologists, they say, no, everything we find beautiful is functional. For example, in general, throughout all cultures, men like women with a certain relatively similar hip to waist ratio. You talk about in the book, if you go to Samoa, women are, you know, a lot bigger because what they find beautiful is bigger than, let's say, in Japan. But someone like Dr. Buss has found that the ratios still say somewhat similar. It's just, you know, it's a ratio. So if the butt is bigger, people still, for example, all like the butt to be bigger, the hips, than the waist. Nobody goes, oh, I met this girl with a flat butt and a huge belly, and that's attractive. So, and the reason that scientists give, other scientists, is that, for example, fertility can be predicted based on this hip to waist ratio. So do you agree with that? Are you challenging that?
So, you know, I spent most of my career working on birds and in great detail. And the work I'm doing in the book on people is new. But I mean, really, to clarify, what the idea is that people think that beauty in nature, whether it's a bird of paradise or a human, is like a biological match.com profile full of information right. That mates need to know about that prospective other mate. You know, who are his people? Does he come from a good egg? Does he have money in the bank? What is he eating? You know, does he have a good diet? Does he smoke? Or even what is he smoking, right? These are the things that mates want to know, right? Does he have sexually transmitted diseases, right? And so what that means is that every detail of ornament in nature is supposed to be a kind of actionable intelligence, right? It's really about detail. Now, the other possibility is that it's merely beautiful, as I would say. That it's attractive for its own sake, right? And the difference between those two ideas is that one is about adaptation, right? If mates are actually better, if the things you prefer are actually better, that means that mating and beauty are just another example of adaptation, right? But if beauty is merely attractive, then that means something distinct. That means that there's other forces in evolutionary biology than adaptation, and that's an interesting conundrum. So to people, yes, Buss and I would disagree about almost everything, in fact. You could start with waist hip ratio. You know, the evidence that's actually associated, it might be attractive to many people, and I don't deny there are some data to support that. But the idea that that's associated with fertility or fitness is actually pretty poor. In fact, a lot of the most beautiful, what are considered to be some of the most beautiful people in the world, fashion models, many of them are so starved that they are essentially unfertile. Yet people find them to be totally attractive. What's with that? If they were, why would you prefer a mate who no longer menstruates or, you know, has no eggs that are available for fertilization, right? So there's lots of ways in which people's actual conception of beauty is not about about improving their fitness. And what evolutionary psychologists and others lack is a critical view of the idea of the importance of natural selection in human evolution or in evolution in general.
So One of the things that you talk about in the book, I took notes here that I thought was really interesting that I think people will like. You're talking about, and I kind of see this, this is towards the end of the book. You said, we humans have evolved through a distinct evolutionary advance of female interests. So one of the things we think about is that men are the decider. I mean, not every, if you know more about the subject, you don't think, but the common person thinks, look, it's men that are determining who's beautiful. It's male. You hear a lot of this, you know, who Playboy magazine or Maxim magazine, they're determining what beauty is. But at the end of the day, it's really women who choose. Like our species, we humans are, it's men will sleep with anything is the basic easy way to say it, but women won't. Even Dr. Helen Fisher did some studies I thought was interesting on animals where they would bring an elephant. You know, there was a female elephant at the San Diego Zoo or something. And they'd bring a male elephant, which looked just like a male elephant to them. And they wanted to have, you know, little elephant babies. So they stuck the male in the pen and the female ran to the other side. She found him unattractive. We couldn't see it, but there was something wrong with that male elephant. And so by her, in effect, running the other way, she was determining that man's DNA or that male's DNA will not continue throughout time. And so are you agreeing that it's really in society, it's women's view and women's choice that's determining much more, they're much more important than men?
Yeah. Well, you know, Ty, talking about human sexuality and the evolution of human sexuality is like the most complicated species there is, right? And why is that? Because everything's going
on. Because women are complicated.
No, you got male choice and female choice. You got male-male competition and female-female competition. You also have male coercion and female coercion. Giving rise to sexual conflict of various kinds. And then on top of that, you have culture, right? And so what that means is we are the most complicated species there is. So it's no wonder we can get our thoughts mixed up or unclear about this, right? So I think, you know, that both male choice and female choice are happening actually real time in people. The question is, how do we get to be the way we are right now? And what I argue in the book is that the decisive feature, the decisive force that made humans distinct from gorillas and chimpanzees, that gave us all of our real differences from the rest of nature, is female mate choice. And you know, the book is long. It takes 250 pages to deal with the birds. And that's only after that do you get started on the mammals and on the people, right? And so understanding people, you know, it might be easier if we talked about birds for 250 pages, but well, let's cut to the people. So what makes us different from apes, right? Well, one of the things that we're really different about apes, if you look at female sexuality in apes and monkeys, especially old war monkeys, your average female is in a totally tough situation. There's some male that is in charge of her and in charge of her sexuality. He basically runs the show, right? So he controls, you know, who she has sex with, et cetera. And he's brutal about it, right? So one of the things that happens in chimpanzees and gorillas and other apes or other monkeys is that if a new guy takes over, right, what's he do? The first thing he does is go and murder all the babies.
Right.
That's called
infanticide.
And the reason is because when females are lactating, when they're supporting a young baby offspring, they're not
fertile.
And so he is in charge of the troop now or the group, and he doesn't have control over he can't expand his fertility. How does he do that? He murders all the babies. Right. And then the females come into estrus, or they come in to become fertile, and then he mates with them all and then expands his own. So this has a huge impact on female lifetime success. Right. And, you know, humans are unique in many ways, but all of them involve an expansion in childhood. Right. Whether it's big brains, language, culture, material culture, all the things that make humans distinctive require longer childhoods in order to create them. And so the question would be, under what conditions would females evolve to invest more in their offspring if a big bunch of them are getting murdered all the time in random social violence, you know, as males battling it with each other? The answer is never. So human evolution required a solution to the infanticide problem. And the question is, how does that arise? In the book, I propose, really for the first time, that the way in which it arose is that females preferred those males that were essentially de-weaponized. And all you got to do is look at a single smile. Can you smile, Kai? Ty? You're going, yeah. Well, what are you showing? You are showing that you do not have fangs in your face.
Right.
You know, our immediate closest relatives, the chimpanzees and gorillas, the males have deadly weapons in their faces. Huh. Deadly weapons that humans lack, human males lack. Now, human males are responsible for basically almost all of the social violence in the world today, right?
Right. It's like 90% of murders are men, and about 70% of them are drunk.
And the women that are probably responding to abuse, which drives them to it in many cases. So the question is, under what conditions will males give up their weapons? That's a big, huge question.
It's when they're forced, because the women won't sleep with them unless they're nice.
That's kind of what the book says. I propose that weapons get lost when they become unsexy. And the way to de-weaponize the males to get them below the belt where it hurts. Right? And that this process was critical to the origin of the human species.
Right.
And all we got to do is look at a human smile to see it. We're all advertising the fact that we lacked it.
We don't have any fangs.
There you go.
So if I want to get rid of a girl that I'm dating, can I put those fake vampire things in and then smile and be like, I will bite you.
Humans have culture too. Culture evolved after this, and culture's a weird thing. I mean, look at the popularity of vampire films, etc. So I don't know. Maybe find that a turn on. That'd be not a thing. So basically, human males are responsible for lots of violence. But one of the things they don't do at any level ever is murder babies for their own sexual advantage.
Right.
And, you know, in apes, this is the primary cause of the death of infants. It's like.
Yeah. Although stepfathers are responsible for about 100 times more abuse than real fathers.
But that's still 0.00001% of infant deaths. In infanticide in gorillas and chimpanzees is responsible for a third of all infant deaths.
Huh.
30%, 35%, right? That's a tremendous difference. And, you know, that's the biggest transformation between humans and apes. And I think it's responsible for how we got here. And I think what it means is basically that that female choice was a critical role. Now, another way to look at this is body size. It turns out that, you know, gorilla males are about twice the size of females. Chimpanzees are about 30% larger. Even bonobos, the famously peaceful and overtly sexual, pygmy chimpanzees, bonobos, are about 20% bigger. But in humans, human males are only 16% larger. Right now, in bonobos, it's a female. It's a complete. There is no sexual conflict. They're completely peaceful. There's no conflict. Right. And yet those bonobo males are larger in body size than females than human females. So how do you get smaller? I think it's body size choice. You know, even right now we have mostly people preferring to mate with people of similar size.
Yeah, would this explain musicians? Because I read an interesting there's a book, I forget what it's called, and it's basically, you know, I even saw some people commenting here on the live stream that women always like the biggest, strongest guy. But if you look at the heartthrobs, the people who get posters on, you know, 20-year-old girl or 19-year-old girl's walls, it's like Justin Bieber. Now, Justin Bieber is not a big guy. He's probably 5'8", 140 pounds, 150, maybe 150. And he's a guy who, you know, sings with not a deep voice, really. So there's a lot of evidence to what you're saying, that women don't just look at fierce guys. Now, what Dr. Buss says, or it's a bimodal. Short term, they look for big guys. They want to settle with smaller guys.
There's a lot of data showing a strong correlation. There are always exceptions. But basically, there's a strong correlation between the size of people in any couple, you know, and the data are very strong. Now, you know, the outliers are interesting, but you know, Justin Bieber doesn't have any role in. He's a sort of an icon. He has some cultural relationship, but he doesn't really play a role in anybody's sexual choices, except for the small world of people that might be around him. There are variations, but there's strong support for that. So I think that basically getting the sexes to be more similar in body size and elimination of canine weapons. And also, transformation of personality. Your average male ape is like a homicidal maniac waiting for his time, you know. And human males are bad in a lot of ways, but they're not like that. And how did that transformation of even human personality come about? I think it came about through female choice, through female mate choice.
So. Practical tips. I don't know if you even go. Some people don't like to jump across the world to the practical tips. Are there practical tips? A man. Let's start with men and then women. From your book, if you were, let's say today was your last day on planet Earth, and you're leaving some advice to your kids, male and female. What do you tell your son, and what do you tell your daughter based on your life's work?
Yeah. Well, I got three sons, and they have absorbed my views very well over a long amount of time. You know, I think the idea that the idea of machismo. Tough and dominant as the core of attraction is deeply flawed and is actually kind of a recipe for unhappiness. And in fact, you know, maleness, I think, in the modern world has taken a real a direction that leads to everyone being unhappy, right? And so I think actually getting in touch with what it means to be caring, both. For your partner and for your offspring is a recipe for everybody's happiness, whether you're male or female. And that stories to the contrary are often supposedly rooted in evolutionary biology, but I think that's that science is just really bad. And this is the book is really about another way to look at evolution that is, I think, really much more consistent with the facts and gives us a really different appreciation for ourselves.
What about for women? What would you tell? I don't know if you have a daughter, but what would you tell your daughter?
I don't have a daughter. I wish.
Your niece.
I love kids. I would have kept going and going. That'd be great.
you know, it's up to me.
Hopefully I would already have, 10, 20 years of relationship with her already. But, this mythical person, it's hard to know what I would deliver one little message, you know. But, the flip side is also true. I mean, the evolutionary psychology view is that sperm are cheap and eggs are expensive. So males should be profligate, you know, and females should be coy. And that may explain sea urchins pretty well, but that doesn't explain humans much at all. So I think a lot of human evolution, you know, if you look at if female mate choice shaped the human species, that means that female mate choice is an important thing, and it's not just about the choice; it's about mating and remating, right? You know, evolutionary biology is or human evolution has really been shaped by female sexuality, and that means female pleasure and the female pursuit of pleasure. I would hope that I would have aspired to raise a daughter who was in touch with that, with her pleasure, and realizing that the pursuit of it is not only an independent right, but something like a celebration of the evolutionary history of her gender, right? This is how we got that way, by females pursuing sexual pleasure, right? It's a it's astounding. And I think that I hope my daughter would be appreciate that lesson.
You know, if you go to Sweden, like, or Scandinavia, where it's much more, you know, Sweden's considered the most feminist country in the world, and Swedish girls sleep with a lot more guys. I mean, it's insane. If you ask the average Swedish girl in Sweden how many guys she slept with, and she's, let's say, 22, it's at least, like, lots of girls are 30 to 50. In America, it's like, if it is that much, girls won't admit it. No, not many girls are going to be like 50.
One of the interesting things about those studies, Ty, is that it finds out that people lie about how many people they've slept with.
And they do. But they don't lie about 50. Girls don't lie about, if the girl says 50,
no,
she slept with 50. In America, if a girl says 10, she's probably lying.
Right now, but there's a psychologist who took American undergrads and asked them, you know, how many people they'd slept with, males and females. And then she does a control group where she straps them up to a fake lie detector test.
Oh, okay.
And then asks them how many they slept with. Okay, in the regular experiment, guys have slept with many more than the women, right?
Right.
And in the fake lie detector experiment where the coils are all there and it's really big and, you know, scary looking. And it turns out that the differences are erased. Not only that, it turns out that women have now slept with more guys than the guys.
Right.
At least, and these are, okay, these are undergraduates. So maybe true of undergraduate guys, right? But
right.
Differences are erased, and they did it exactly in the way that the culture of the time would demand these people behave, that women
right.
should be coy and men should be successful, right?
But how ugly were these
Zach these has participants? A very serious question.
Yeah, I'm curious to know. I mean, I imagine that would come into play.
You know, their data to test exactly this idea, and it establishes, regardless of the actual numbers, it establishes that that people lie, and people lie in ways that are conforming to what the culture kind of demands of them. Right.
So let me. I'm gonna take some questions. I'm gonna give $100 away right now. We're gonna PayPal. We're gonna video this, Adrian. And okay, here we go. Sam. Did Sam die? Okay. Here's the $100. First person who answers this question, based on the talk we've had here with Professor Prum or Rick, how on average, how much bigger is the average male human versus female human? How much bigger are men on average? Body weight, body size. There we go. Will Plant, 16%, paying attention. $100, sending it to you. By the way, stay to the end because I'm giving away this iPhone at the end of my talk. I'll be doing a series of talks, so make sure you keep watching.
Wow, I should do this in my Yale classes.
Humans respond to rewards. Now, I want to talk about beauty for a second in the sense, because this is you talked about the subjective nature of beauty. Like in Samoa, they like big women and big guys. In some of the tribes in Africa, they've selected for big butts. And you even see that in, you know, rap music. It's people who are African American or African descent. Their music is a little different than Taylor Swift in terms of the ideal woman if you watch the music videos. Now, I'm not stereotyping because there's obviously wide variety, but that's a pretty freaking fair assessment. Rap talks more about big butts, and you can trace this back to these tribes in Africa that selected for butts. Are there universal standards of beauty, though? Are there, you know, a certain ratio between your cheekbones and your chin and things like this? Are big boobs, you know, universally more attractive throughout history? Not looking at aberrations, but in general, what do you think on that subject?
I think the answer is obviously no. And one of the ways you know is that the human diversity is the result of the history of human mate choice, right? I mean, people that are around today are here because somebody made it, right? And thrives for them, right? And people look different around the world because not only because of natural selection, but because of ideas about beauty on different parts of the world. Culture changed, and culture influenced the mate choices. And so there are practically no standards of beauty that would apply across across all population of people. Now, having two eyes as opposed to one, or you know, these.
You like two-eyed or one-eyed women, Zach? James, what's your preference?
Other than that, the real criteria that people look, all you got to do is go to an art museum and you look at, you know, from Western culture, these statues of Athena and Aphrodite, and these were women so beautiful that they were considered worthy of worship, right, as goddesses. And these individuals today wouldn't turn anybody's head or make it through a single casting call at a Pepsi commercial, right? And so, that's Western culture. There's nothing genetically distinct about those things. Culture changes. Ideas about beauty change.
So do you think if we went back in time and we took Brad Pitt and we put him in his swimsuit, we dropped him off at any culture in the world, and we also had Danny DeVito, and we take him and we drop him off, or I don't know who's another not so attractive guy.
I don't want to go on record saying names because they might listen to your podcast.
Okay, so Danny DeVito, we drop him off. Is there any culture where the women go, this Danny DeVito guy, he is great looking, and this other dude is just disgusting?
Wait till they open their mouths.
So you think personality could have a thing?
I mean, DeVito is why do you think he is a motor mouth and such a moment by instant, hysterically right. Funny person, right?
But do you think it could be, so going back to your thing, you're saying how if beauty is all that mattered in the sense that we think of beauty, then lots of ugly people, quote unquote ugly, have kids. But could that be because that's all the man could get? You know, Chris Rock, the comedian, he says, and I don't know if you agree with this, he says, a man is only as faithful as his options. So one of the things in classic evolutionary biology is that there is monogamy, but there's a straight line correlation. The more access a man could get, whether it be through being more powerful, whether it be through having more money, they inevitably get women who are more beautiful in that culture. Like, if you a good example would be Billy Joel married a supermodel. What was his wife? Was it Christy Brinkley? If you look at Billy Joel, he wasn't so attractive, but he got money, right? And he had more options, and he didn't settle for a girl that's not so attractive. And so do you think men are only as fake? Because, I mean, your book kind of says that. It says that women...
I'm going to say, I don't know... when Billy Joel or Billy or whoever married Christy Brinkley, whether it was before or after the money, but be that as
after, definitely after.
That is, yeah. I think money is a new invention. You know, we started evolving independently from chimpanzees, you know, 5 to 8 million years ago, right? That's a long, long time. Money was invented after agriculture about 10,000 years ago. So, you know, that has changed culture and changed our behavior quite a bit. And I think it has changed sexual culture. But the other thing to note is that these people are not that much happier than people with less money and fewer options, if you will. You know, and that's why the newspapers are filled with, or gossip columns are filled with, like, the screwed up lives of rich, beautiful people. You know, that is not a path to, like, any kind of success or fun in life, right? There's no. It may seem fun in the moment, but it's not a recipe for happiness. And so, I would think that in the long run, humans were built to be, we evolved to be satisfied, not to be like unsatisfied, profligate and unsatisfied, right? And so though that might be happening around now, but it's certainly not an admirable thing, I don't think.
So you think that the best state for humans is a monogamous husband and wife? That is the best state for, that's our natural state now?
I think we're built for happiness. And happiness doesn't last forever, right? Or necessarily. Right. But I think, you know, the thing that makes us different from the apes is this long childhood. And in chimpanzees and gorillas, 100% of the parental care is done by females, right? Females are doing all of the caring, right? And not only the males, they don't interact with their children, they don't recognize them, they don't even identify as dads, right? The chimpanzee doesn't know who he's the dad of, right? And so
it's like some people alive now,
right? That's true.
That hasn't changed.
But the human males are different, right? Not only do they identify with their kids and experience pride or experience interest and experience, you know, joy in their thriving, they're involved in almost every culture of the world, right? And that difference. How did the guy get to be like that? He got to be like that because men who behave that way were attractive to females. And not only that, if the male is participating, you know what? That kid does better, lives longer, grows up with more food and blah, blah, you know, and so it does better. So yes, I think that parental investment by both sexes is important, or was important. It wasn't permanent. And I don't think it's permanent necessarily in any part of the world or culture, but it was long enough so that the offspring actually could benefit, right? That means a lot of time, some time. And, you know, and that's not, I don't think that's going to be surprising to anybody to see that as some kind of an evolved state for humans. Now, I'm not prescribing that that's the way people should be, but I think people are realizing that, using your telephone to hook up at a high rate is not a recipe
Tinder.
For happy.
You're talking about Tinder, I'm assuming.
You know, males or females. Yeah. Now, the fact is that, you know, I'm proposing that human evolution occurred because females made a lot of choices. And those choices are not just mating choices, they're remating choices, you know? Right? Most of human sexuality is not about fertilization of eggs. It's actually, even in a population without birth control, it's about less than a quarter, less than 20% of, you know, copulation events are going to give rise to some kind of, fertilization, right? And so that means 80% of the time, it's not about reproduction, it's about sampling. And so females have the chance to choose, did I like that? And do I like that again? That re-choice and re-choice requires at least some flexibility in sexuality. So it's not really about monogamy as we conceive of it, but choice and co-investment. I think those are conditions that we can say are natural. And what makes that work is really getting to know each other. You know, most of the literature on that evolutionary psychologists do, they show people pictures and they ask you in a third of a second to evaluate, you know, how hot is this person, right? But the fact is that turns out to be a very poor indication of what we actually experience in life. The fact is that interacting with somebody is like, wow, that person is an asshole, or that person is really attractive. Why was it that I'm so interested in that person? Because we're more than just, you know, what we look like. We're personalities. And so that is an evolved part of human sexuality too. How much do I enjoy being with this person? That's not an accident. You know, chimps go around, they don't really look like they enjoy being with each other. Mostly. Why is that? Because
that's like Zach
it's
on
like
a date.
Some, I've seen some couples that look like they're chimps.
They
look like very, very unhappy people.
And let me read something. I thought this was a great practical takeaway from the book. This is on iBooks, by the way, for those of you coming late. I'm with Professor Prum here, The Evolution of Beauty is his book. He's a professor at Yale. On page 361 of iBooks, it says, Patricelli did an experiment. She used a robotic stuffed female vagina, which looked kind of like, or it was a female fake bird with a fake vagina. But okay, Patricelli was able to confirm her hypothesis that female satin bowerbirds are communicating their comfort level to displaying males by crouching. You see that with chickens, like if a female likes it. But this is the interesting point. Number two, Some males modulated their display intensity to put the females more at ease. And three, those, and this is the main takeaway that I got from this chapter, those males who can regulate their display intensity to keep females more comfortable are ultimately the most successful at attracting mates. And I'll tell you, this subject of big guys, I have some big guys that I work out and do different martial arts, and I got some big guys that hang out with me. And one of the most common things a woman will say, like, Rome is 6'6", 320 pounds. And women go, I love him because he's like a cuddly teddy bear. So they don't actually, they do like, you know, he's big, but they also like what this chapter talks about. A man that can modulate and show that he's not just a tough guy and he can lower his voice. And if you, it's not always the traditional alpha male. And you see, I used to own nightclubs. It's not always the alpha that gets all the, Justin Bieber's not an alpha, but he gets a few, I mean, he gets a lot of women. And DiCaprio, and you look at some of these archetypes of what women like nowadays, and there is a lot of this. So I think men, we have to learn that you got to be able to turn it on and turn it off a little bit, your macho, your machismo.
What's interesting about Bowerbirds is that, you know, they live to be 20, 25 years old. So, you know, they have those older males have a lot of experience. And that means experience being either good or bad at, you know, attracting mates. So a lot of that, what makes that plausible is the males that moderate their display behavior have more experience. They're older, tend to be, at least in the Bowerbirds. And what that means is that, you know, they're socially complicated. The guy that just rushes in and does all these wild displays and freaks out the female is, you know, just awkward and distracting, right? And so, and, you know, he either learns or changes or he doesn't and is unsuccessful, right? So those males that are successful are the ones that are socially attentive. And that's speaks also to the fact that, you know, we're not the only species to think that personality is important, because how are these Bowerbirds varying? The males different vary. They vary in personality. They vary in, you know, how sensitive they are to the responses of the other individuals. Some of them are just brash, and some of them are extremely tuned in, and it matters to females.
Well, good. I know we went over time. You were gracious enough to stay a little longer. I just want to give a shout out to your book, because it is an interesting book. I've read it 1.5 times. Daniel Lieberman and Jared Diamond recommends. Jared Diamond's Pulitzer Prize winner. Daniel Lieberman wrote one of my favorite books, The Story of the Human Body. He's a Harvard guy. All recommend. So go out and grab The Evolution of Beauty by Richard Prum, How Darwin's Forgotten Theory of Mate Choice Shapes the Animal World. iBooks, it's on there. I get books on iBooks all the time because it's so easy to take notes and they store forever. So sometimes I lose books. I have probably 10,000 books I own. So today we couldn't find The Evolution of Beauty, but I had it on my phone. And it was powerful.
I'm glad you found a copy to hold up so you didn't have to hold up your phone.
Yeah, hold on my phone. Hey, thanks so much for being here.
I appreciate your interest in the book.
Awesome. Thanks so much. So I'm going to be back. I'm going to take a little break, and we're going to be giving away on a new live stream the iPhone 7. We gave away some money. Thanks so much, and talk to you guys soon. Thank you.
Take care. Goodbye.